The wings had shattered and broken off. The fuselage smashed down onto the cobbles and slid on. "Now is the time to panic," said Rincewind. The stricken kite continued to scrape across the flagstones in a growing smell of scorched wood. A pale hand reached past Rincewind. "It would be advisable," said Leonard, "to hold on to something." He pulled a small handle labelled Sicarb. Now the kite stopped, in a very dynamic sort of way. The gods looked down. A hatch opened in the strange wooden bird. It fell off and rolled a little way. The gods saw a figure get out. He appeared, in many ways, to be a hero, except that he was far too clean. He looked around, removed his helmet, and saluted.
"Good afternoon, almighty ones," he said. "I do apologize, but this should not take long. And may I take this opportunity to say, on behalf of the people of the Disk, that you are all doing a wonderful job here."
He marched towards the horde, past the astonished gods, and stopped in front of Cohen.
"Cohen the Barbarian, what's it to you?" said Cohen, mystified. "I am Captain Carrot of the Ankh-Morpork City Watch, and I hereby arrest you on a charge of conspiracy to end the world. You need not say anything."
"I don't intend to say anything," said Cohen, raising his sword. "I'm just going to cut your head off."
"Hold it, hold it," said Boy Willie urgently. "Do you know who we all are?"
"Yes, sir, I believe I do. You are Boy Willie, a.k.a. Mad Bill, Wilhelm the Chopper, the Great—"
"And you are going to arrest us? You say you are some kind of watchman?"
"That is correct, sir."
"We must have killed hundreds of watchmen in our time, lad."
"I'm sorry to hear that, sir."
"How much do they pay you, boy?"
said Caleb.
$43 a month, Mr. Ripper, with allowances."
The horde burst out laughing. Then Carrot drew his sword.
"I must insist, sir. What you are planning to do will destroy the world."
"Only this bit, lad," said Cohen. "Now you could go off home and—"
"I'm being patient, sir, out of respect for your grey hairs."
There was a further burst of laughing, and Mad Hamish had to be slapped on the back.
"Just a moment, boys," said Mrs. McGarry quietly. "Are we thinking this one through? Look around you."
They looked around.
"Well?"
Cohen demanded.
"There's me, and you," said Vina, "and Truckle, and Boy Willie, and Hamish, and Caleb, and a minstrel."
So?
"That's seven," said Vina. "Seven of us against one of him. Seven against one, and he thinks he's going to save the world, and he knows who we are, and he's going to fight us."
"You think he's the hero?"
cackled Mad Hamish.
"Ha! What kind of hero works for $43 a month, plus allowances?"
But the cackle was all alone in the sudden quietness. The horde could calculate the peculiar mathematics of heroism quite quickly. There always was, at the start and finish, the code. They lived by the code. You followed the code, and you became part of the code for those who followed you. The code was it. Without the code, you weren't a hero. You were just a thug in a loincloth. The code was quite clear. One brave man against seven. One. They knew it was true. In the past, they'd all relied on it. The higher the odds, the greater the victory. That was the code. Forget the code, dismiss the code, deny the code, and the code would take you. They looked down at Captain Carrot's sword. It was short, sharp, and plain. It was a working sword. It had no runes on it, no mystic gleam twinkled on its edge. If you believed in the code, that was worrying. One simple sword in the hands of a truly brave man could cut through a magical sword like suet. It wasn't a frightening thought, but it was a thought.
"Funny thing," said Cohen, "but I heard tell once that down in Ankh-Morpork there's some watchman who's really heir to the throne, but keeps very quiet about it because he likes being a watchman."
"Oh, dear," thought the horde. "Kings in disguise, that was code material right there." Carrot met Cohen's gaze.
"Never heard of him," he said.
"To die for $43 a month," said Cohen, holding the gaze. "A man's got to be very, very stupid, or very, very brave."
"What's the difference?" said Rincewind, stepping forward. "Look, I don't want to break up a moment of drama or anything, but he's not joking. If that keg explodes here, it will destroy the world. It'll open up a sort of hole and all the magic will drain away."
"Rincewind?" said Cohen. "What are you doing here, you old rat?"
"Trying to save the world," said Rincewind. He rolled his eyes.
Again?
Cohen looked uncertain, but heroes don't back down easily, even in the face of the code.
It'll really all blow up?
Yes.
It's not much for a world, Cohen muttered. Not any more.
What about all the dear little kittens?
Rincewind began.
Puppies,
hissed Carrot, not taking his eyes off Cohen.
Puppies, I mean, eh? Eh? Think of them.
Well, what about them?
Oh, nothing.
But everyone will die, said Carrot.
Cohen shrugged his skinny shoulders.
Everyone dies sooner or later, so we're told.
There would be no one left to remember, said the minstrel, as if he was talking to himself. If there's no one left alive, no one will remember.
The horde looked at him.
No one will remember who you were or what you did, he went on. There will be nothing. No more songs. No one will remember.
Cohen sighed. All right, then let's say, supposing I don't...
Cohen,
said Truckle in an unusually worried voice.
You know, a few minutes ago where you said, press the plunger?
Yeah?
You meant I shouldn't have?
The keg was sizzling.
You pressed it, said Cohen.
Well, yes, you said.
Can we stop it?
No,
said Rincewind.
Can we outrun it?
Only if you can think of a way to run 10 miles really, really fast, said Rincewind.
Gather round, lads. Not you, minstrel boy. This is sword stuff.
Cohen beckoned the other heroes, and they went into a hurried huddle. It didn't seem to take long.
Right, said Cohen as they straightened up. You've got all our names down, right, Mr. Bard?
Of course.
Then let's go, lads.
They heaved the keg back onto Hamish's wheelchair. Truckle half turned as they started to push it.
Here, Bard! You sure you made a note of that bit where I...
We are leaving, shouted Cohen, grabbing him. See you later, Mrs. McGarry.
She nodded and stood back.
You know how it is, she said sadly. Great-grandchildren on the way and everything.
The wheelchair was already moving fast.
Get them to name one after me,
yelled Cohen as he leapt aboard.
What are they doing?
Said Rincewind as the chair rolled down the street towards the far gates.
They'll never get it down from the mountain quickly enough,
said Carrot, starting to run. The chair passed through the arch at the end of the street and rattled over the icy rocks. As they hurried after it, Rincewind saw it bounce out and into 10 miles of empty air. He thought he heard the last words as the downward plunge began.
Aren't we supposed to shout something?
Then chair and figures and barrel became smaller and smaller and merged into the hazy landscape of snow and sharp, hungry rocks. Carrot and Rincewind watched. After a while, the wizard noticed Leonard out of the corner of his eye. The man had his fingers on his own pulse and was counting under his breath.
10 miles, Allow for air resistance, call it 3 minutes plus. Yes, yes, indeed. We should be averting our gaze around... Yes, now. Yes, I think it would be a good idea.
Even through closed lids, the world went red. When Rincewind crawled to the edge, he saw a small, distant circle of evil black and crimson. Several seconds later, thunder boomed up the flanks of Corrie Celesti, causing avalanches. And that, too, died away.
"Do you think they survived?"
said Carrot, peering down into the fog of dislodged snow.
"Huh?"
said Rincewind.
"It wouldn't be the proper story if they didn't survive."
"Captain, they fell about 10 miles into an explosion which has just reduced a mountain into a valley," said Rincewind.
"They could have landed in really deep snow or on some ledge,"
said Carrot.
"Or there may have been a passing flock of really large soft birds," said Rincewind.
Carrot bit his lip.
"On the other hand, giving up their lives to save everyone in the world, that's a good ending too. But it was them who were going to blow it up. Still very brave of them, though."
"In a way, I suppose."
Carrot shook his head sadly.
"Perhaps we should get down and check. It's a great bubbling crater of boiling rock,"
Rincewind burst out.
"It'd take a miracle. There's always hope."
"So? There's always taxis, too. It doesn't make any difference."
Carrot sighed and straightened up.
"I wish you weren't right."
"You wish I wasn't right?
Come on, let's get back. We're not exactly out of trouble ourselves, are we?"
Behind them, Vina blew her nose and then tucked her handkerchief back into her armoured corset. It was time, she thought, to follow the smell of horses. The remains of the kite were the subject of keen but uncomprehending interest among the dietic classes. They weren't certain what it was, but they definitely disapproved of it.
"I feel," said Blind Io, "that if we had wanted people to fly, we would have given them wings."
"We allow broomsticks and magic carpets," said Offler.
"Ah, but they're magical. Magic religion, there is a certain association. This is an attempt to subvert the natural order. Just anyone could float around the place in one of these things."
He shuddered.
"Men could look down upon their gods."
He looked down upon Leonard O'Quirm.
"Why did you do it?"
"You gave me wings when you showed me birds," said Leonard O'Quirm. "I just made what I saw." The rest of the gods said nothing. Like many professionally religious people, they were pretty professional being gods, they tended towards unease in the presence of the unashamedly spiritual.
"None of us recognize you as a worshipper," said Io. "Are you an atheist?"
"I think I can say that I definitely believe in the gods," said Leonard, looking around. This seemed to satisfy everyone except Fate.
"And that is all," he said.
Leonard thought for a while. "I think I believe in the secret geometries, and the colours on the edge of light, and the marvellous in everything," he said.
"So you're not a religious man, then?" said Blind Io.
"I am a painter."
"That's a no, then, is it? I want to be clear on this."
I don't understand the question," said Leonard.
"As you ask it." "I don't think we understand the answers," said Fate, "as you give them." "But I suppose we owe you something," said Blind Io. "Never let it be said the gods are unjust."
"We don't let it be said the gods are unjust," said Fate. "If I may suggest..."
"Will you be silent?" Blind Io thundered. "We'll do it the old way, thank you."
He turned to the explorers and pointed a finger at Leonard.
"Your penalty," said Blind Io, "is this. You will paint the ceiling of the Temple of Small Gods in Ankh-Morpork. All of it. The decoration is in a terrible state."
"But that's not fair," said Carrot. "He's not a young man, and it took the great Angelino Tweebsley 20 years to paint that ceiling."
"Then it will keep his mind occupied," said Fate, "and prevent him thinking the wrong sort of thoughts. That is the correct punishment for those who usurp the powers of the gods. We will find work for idle hands to do."
Said Leonard. "A considerable amount of scaffolding."
"Vast amounts," said Offler with satisfaction.
"And the nature of the painting?" said Leonard. "I would like to paint
the entire world," said Fate. "Nothing less."
"Really? I was thinking of perhaps just a nice duck egg blue with a few stars," said Blind Io.
"The entire world," said Leonard, staring off into some private vision, "with elephants and dragons and a swirl of clouds and mighty forests and the currents of the sea and birds and the great yellow velts and the pattern of storms and the crests of mountains."
Yes, said Blind Io.
"Without assistance," said Fate.
"Even with the scaffolding," said Offler.
"That is monstrous," said Carrot.
Blind Io said,
"And if it is not completed in 20 years...
10 years, said Fate.
10 years, the city of Ankh-Morpork will be raised with heavenly fire."
Yes, good idea," said Leonard, still staring at nothing. "Some of the birds will have to be quite small." "He's in shock," said Rincewind. Captain Carrot had gone quiet with anger, as Skye does just before a thunderstorm.
"Tell me," said Blind Io, "is there a god of policemen?"
"No, sir," said Carrot. "Coppers would be far too suspicious of anyone calling themselves a god of policemen to believe in one."
"But are you a gods-fearing man?"
"What I've seen of them certainly frightens the life out of me, sir. And my commander always says, when we go about our business in the city, that when you look at the state of mankind, you are forced to accept the reality of the gods."
The gods smiled their approval of this, which was indeed an accurate quotation. Gods have little use for irony.
"Very good," said Blind Io. "And you have a request?"
"Sir?"
"Everyone wants something from the gods."
"No, sir. I offer you an opportunity."
"You will give something to us?"
"Yes, sir. A wonderful opportunity to show justice and mercy."
I ask you, sir, to grant me a boon."
There was a silence. Then Blind Io said,
"Is that one of those wooden objects, wasn't it, with a handle and beads on one side, and a sort of, you know, thing with hooks on?" He paused. Did you mean one of those rubber things?"
"No, sir, that would be a balloon, sir. A boon is a request."
"Is that all? Oh, well, allow the kite to be repaired so that we can go home."
"Impossible," said Fate.
"It sounds reasonable to me," said Blind Io, glaring at Fate. "It must be its last flight."
"It will be the last flight of the kite, won't it?" said Carrots to Leonard.
"Hmm? What? Oh, yes, oh, certainly, yeah. I can see I designed a lot of it wrong. The next one..."
"What happened there?" said Fate suspiciously.
"Where?" said Rincewind.
"Where you clamped your hand over his mouth."
"Did I?"
"You're still doing it."
"Nerves," said Rincewind, releasing his grip on Leonard. I've been a bit shaken up."
"And do you want a boon too?" said Leonard.
"What? No, I'd prefer a balloon, as a matter of fact. A blue balloon."
Rincewind gave Carrot a defiant look.
"It's all got to do with when I was six, all right. There was this big, unpleasant girl and a pin. I don't want to talk about it."
He looked up at the watching gods.
"I don't know what everyone's staring at, I'm sure."
"Hook,"
said the librarian.
"Does your pet want a balloon as well?" said Blind Io. "We do have a monkey god if he wants some mangoes and so on."
In the sudden chill, Rincewind said,
"In fact, he said he wants 3,000 file cards, a new stamp, and 5 gallons of ink."
"Eek!"
said the librarian urgently. "Oh, all right. And a red balloon too, please, if they're free." The repairing of the kite was simple enough. Although gods, on the whole, do not feel at home around mechanical things, every pantheon everywhere in the universe finds it necessary to have some minor deity, Vulcan, Wayland, Dennis, Hephaistos, who knows how bits fit together and that sort of thing. Most large organisations, to their regret and expense, have to have someone like that. Evil Harry surfaced from the snowdrift and gasped for breath. Then he was plunged back down again by a firm hand.
"So it's a deal, then, is it?" said the minstrel, who was kneeling on his back and holding on to his hair.
Evil Harry rose again.
"Deal!" he roared, spitting snow. "And if you tell me later that I shouldn't have listened to you, because everyone knows Dark Lords can't be trusted, I'll garrote you with a lyre string."
"You've got no respect."
"Well, you are an evil, treacherous Dark Lord, right?"
said the minstrel, pushing the spluttering head back into the snow.
"Well, yeah, of course, obviously, but respect costs nothing."
"You help get me down, and I'll write you into the saga as the most wicked, iniquitous, and depraved evil warlord there has ever been, understand?"
The head came up again, wheezing.
All right, but you've got to promise..."
"And if you betray me, remember that I don't know the code. I don't have to let Dark Lords get away."
They descended in silence, and, in Harry's case, mostly with his eyes shut. Off to one side and a long way down, a foothill was now a valley, still fumed and bubbled.
"We'd never even find the bodies," said the minstrel as they sought for a path.
"Ah, and that'd be because they didn't die, see?" said Harry. "They'd have come up with some plan at the last minute, you can bet on it."
"Harry..."
"You can call me Evil, lad."
"Evil... they spent the last minute falling down a mountain."
"Oh, but maybe they kind of glided through the air, see? And there's all those lakes down there. Or maybe they spotted where the snow was really deep."
The minstrel stared.
"You really think they could have survived?" he said.
There was a slight touch of desperation in Harry's raddled face.
"Sure, of course. All that talk from Cohen, that was just talk. He's not the sort to go around dying all the time. Not old Cohen. I mean, not him. He's one of a kind."
The minstrel surveyed the hublands ahead of them. There were lakes and there was deep snow. But the horde was not in favour of cunning. If they needed cunning, they hired it. Otherwise, they simply attacked. And you couldn't attack the ground. "It's all mixed up," he thought. "Just like that captain said, gods and heroes and wild adventure. But when the last hero goes, it all goes."
He'd never been keen on heroes, but he realised that he needed them to be there, like forests and mountains. He might never see them, but they filled some sort of hole in his mind, some sort of hole in everyone's mind.
"Bound to be fine," said Evil Harry behind him. "They'll probably be waiting for us when we get down there."
"What's that hanging on that rock?" said the minstrel. It turned out, when they'd scrambled up to it over slippery rocks, to be part of a shattered wheel from Mad Hamish's wheelchair.
"Doesn't mean nothing," said Evil Harry, tossing it aside. "Come on, let's get a move on. This is not a mountain you want to be on at night."
"No, you're right, it doesn't," said the minstrel. He unslung his lyre and began to tune it. "It doesn't mean anything."
Before he turned to leave, he reached into a ragged pocket and pulled out a small leather bag. It was full of rubies. He tipped them out onto the snow where they glowed, and then he walked on. There was a field of deep snow. Here and there a hollow suggested that the snow had been thrust aside with great force by a falling body, but the edges had been softened by the wind drift. The seven horsewomen landed gently, and the thing about the snow was this. There were hoof prints in it, but they did not appear exactly where the horses trod, or exactly when they did. They seemed superimposed on the world, as if they had been drawn first and the artist did not have much time to paint in the reality behind them. They waited for a while.
"Well, this is jolly unsatisfactory," said Hilda, soprano. "They ought to be here. They do know they're dead, don't they?"
"We haven't come to the wrong place, have we?" said Gertrude, mezzo-soprano.
"Ladies, if you'd be so kind to dismount..."
They turned. The seventh Valkyrie had drawn her sword and was smiling at them.
"What cheek! Here, you're not Grimhilda."
"No, but I think I could probably beat all six of you," said Vina, tossing aside the helmet. "I shoved her in the privy with one hand. It would be better if you simply dismounted."
"Better? Better than what?"
Mrs. McGarry sighed.
"This," she said.
The snow erupted old men.
"Evening, miss," said Cohen, grabbing Hilda's bridle. "Now, are you going to do like she says, or shall I get my friend Truckle here to ask you? Only he's a bit uncivil."
"How dare you?"
"I'll dare anything, miss. Now get off or I'll push her off."
"Well, really?"
"Excuse me, I say excuse me," said Gertrude. "Are you dead?"
"Are we dead, Willie?"
"We ought to be dead, but I don't feel dead."
"I ain't dead," roared Mad Hamish. "I'll knock any man down as tells me I'm dead."
"There's an offer you can't refuse," said Cohen, swinging himself onto Hilda's horse. "Saddle up, boys."
"But excuse me," said Gertrude,
who was one of those people afflicted with terminal politeness.
"We were supposed to take you to the great halls of the slain. There's mead and roast pork and fighting in between courses, just for you. That's what you wanted. They laid it on just for you."
"Yeah? Well, thanks all the same, but we ain't going," said Cohen.
"But that's where dead heroes have got to go."
"I don't remember signing anything," said Cohen.
He looked up at the sky. The sun had set, and the first stars were coming out. Every one was a world, eh?
"You still not joining us, Mrs. McGarry?" he said.
"Not yet, boys," Vina smiled. "Not quite ready, I think. There'll come a time."
"Fair enough, fair enough. We'll be going in. Got a lot to do.
But..."
Mrs. McGarry looked across the snowfield. The wind had blown the snow over shapes. Here a sword hilt projected from a drift. There a sandal was just visible.
"Are you dead or not?" she said.
Cohen scanned the snow.
"Well, the way I see it, we don't think we are, so why should we care what anyone else thinks? We never have. Ready, Hamish? Then follow me, boys!"
Vina watched as the Valkyries, squabbling amongst themselves, made their way back to the mountain. Then she waited. She had a feeling that there would be something to wait for. After a while, she heard another horse whinny.
"Are you collecting?" she said,
and turned to look at the mounted figure.
"That is something about which I do not propose to enlighten you," said Death.
"But you are here," said Vina, although now she felt a lot more like Mrs. McGarry again. Vina would probably have killed a few of the horsewomen just to make sure the others paid attention, but they'd all looked so young.
"I am, of course, everywhere,"
Mrs. McGarry looked up at the stars. "In the olden days," she said, "when a hero had been really heroic, the gods would put them up in the stars."
"The heavens change," said Death. "What today looks like a mighty hunter may look like a teacup in 100 years' time."
"That doesn't seem fair."
"No one ever said it had to be. But there are other stars."
At the base of the mountain, at Vina's camp, Harry got the fire going again while the minstrels sat and picked out notes. "I want you to listen to this," he said after a while, and played something. It went on, it seemed to evil Harry, for a lifetime. He wiped away a tear as the last notes died away. "I've got to do some more work on it," said the minstrel in a faraway voice. "But will it do?"
"You asking me, will it do?" said evil Harry. "You're telling me you think you could make it even better?"
"Yes."
"Well, it's not like a real saga," said evil Harry hoarsely. "It's got a tune. You could whistle it, even. Well, hum it. I mean, it even sounds like them. Like they'd sound if they was music."
"Good.
It's wonderful."
"Thank you. It will get better as more people hear it. It's music for people to listen to."
"And it's not like we found any bodies, is it?" said the very small Dark Lord. "So they could be alive somewhere."
The minstrel picked a few notes on the lyre. The strings shimmered. "Somewhere," he agreed.
"You know, kid," said Harry, "I don't even know your name."
The minstrel's brow wrinkled. He wasn't certain himself anymore, and he didn't know where he was going to go, or what he was going to do. But he suspected that life might be a lot more interesting from now on. "I'm just the singer," he said.
"Play it again," said evil Harry.
Rincewind blinked, stared, and then looked away from the window. "We've just been overtaken by some men on horseback," he said.
"Ook,"
said the librarian, which probably meant some of us have got some flying to do.
"I just thought I'd mention it."
Spiralling through the air like a drunken clown, the kite climbed the column of hot air from the distant crater. It was the only instruction Leonard had given before going and sitting so quietly at the back of the cabin that Carrot was getting seriously worried. "He just sits there, whispering things like 10 years and the whole world," he reported. "It's come as a terrible shock. What a penance." "But he looks cheerful," said Rincewind, "and he keeps drawing sketches. And he's leafing through all those pictures you took on the moon."
"Poor chap. It's affecting his mind," Carrot leaned forward. "We ought to get him home as soon as possible. What's the usual direction? Second star to the left and straight on till morning?"
"I think that may very probably be the stupidest piece of astro-navigation ever suggested," said Rincewind. "We're just going to head for the lights. Oh, and we'd better be careful not to look down on the gods." Carrot nodded. "That's quite hard."
"Practically impossible," said Rincewind.
And in a place on no map, the immortal Mazda, bringer of fire, lay on his eternal rock. Memory can play tricks after the first 10,000 years, and he wasn't quite sure what had happened. There had been some old men on horseback who'd swooped out of the sky. They'd cut his chains and given him a drink, and had taken it in turns to shake his withered hand. Then they'd ridden away into the stars as quickly as they'd come. Mazda lay back into the shape his body had worn into the stone over the centuries. He wasn't quite sure about the men, or why they'd come, or why they'd been so happy. He was only sure, in fact, about two things. He was sure it was nearly dawn. He was sure that he held in his right hand the very sharp sword the old men had given him. And he could hear, coming closer with the dawn, the beat of an eagle's wings. He was going to enjoy this. It is in the nature of things that those who save the world from certain destruction often don't get hugely rewarded, because since the certain destruction does not take place, people are uncertain how certain it may have been and are therefore somewhat tight when it comes to handing out anything more substantial than praise. The kite was landed rather roughly on the corrugated surface of the River Ankh, and, as happens to public things lying around which don't appear to belong to anyone, quickly became the private property of many, many people. and Leonard began the penance for his hubris. This was much approved of by the Ankh-Morpork priesthood. It was definitely the sort of thing to encourage piety. Lord Vetinari was therefore surprised when he received an urgent message 3 weeks after the events recounted, and forced his way through the mob to the Temple of Small Gods. "What's going on?" he demanded of the priests peering around the door.
"This is blasphemy," said Hunon Ridcully.
"Why? What has he painted?"
"It's not what he's painted, my lord. What he's painted is amazing. And he's finished it."
Up on the mountain, as the blizzards closed in, there was a red glow in the snow. It was there all winter, and when the spring gales blew, the rubies glittered in the sunshine. No one remembers the singer. The song remains. That is the end of The Last Hero. It was written by Terry Pratchett and read by Stephen Briggs.
This has been an ISIS audiobooks presentation. For further details of our extensive range of books on audio cassette and CD, please call our free phone number, which is 0800 731 5637.